So we're in the book of Exodus, we're working through this book in our Sunday mornings, and we're in chapter 19 this morning, and verses 1 to 8, that section that we read a few minutes ago. Now a phrase that you're likely to hear in a church like ours is the phrase, a relationship with God. Having a relationship with God is something we evangelical Christians are into. But what does it mean? What is a relationship with God? Well, Israel had a relationship with God. And actually, the passage that we're looking at this morning particularly focuses on that. It's particularly interested in this relationship which Israel has with God. And I think then that these verses can help us answer that question which I posed just now. What is a relationship with God? Indeed, I think they enable us to make four important assertions. And first of all, then, it's a relationship that's everything. What is a relationship with God? It's a relationship that's everything. So the setting for our passage is Mount Sinai. That's where Israel has come to in her journey. If you want the chronological and geographical details, you can get those there in verses 1 and 2. But it's in verse 3 that things really start to get interesting, because in verse 3, Moses, there at Sinai, separates himself from the Israelite camp and heads off up the mountain. And it isn't that he wants to enjoy some panoramic views, nor that a spot of fell running is a favourite pastime of this 80-year-old man. It's rather that a meeting with God awaits him there on those lofty slopes. And this meeting with God then, as it occurs there in those verses, it's God who does all the talking in it. And he begins in verse 3, making it clear that his message is for all Israel. It isn't just for Moses. And then in verse 4, he provides, if you like, a one-sentence summary of the Exodus. Now, we'll talk more about this summary later, but at this point, I just want you to notice how it ends. It ends with the preposition to, followed by another word. And in this ending to the summary, God is expressing the goal of the Exodus, the destination of this journey from Egypt. It wasn't an aimless, directionless venture. It was to something. But what was it to? What was the Exodus to? Was it to freedom from slavery? Was that its great goal? Was it to Canaan, the land flowing with milk and honey? Was that what it was ultimately all aimed at? Well, no. What follows the preposition to at the end of this summary of the Exodus is neither freedom from slavery nor the land of Canaan. What follows the preposition to is one simple word. Myself. Myself. It's God speaking, remember. And the point, then, is this, that the goal of the Exodus was Israel being in a relationship with God. Freedom from slavery and the land of Canaan, they weren't inconsequential by any means. They were important and indeed magnificent outcomes of the Exodus. But they could not compete with the supreme outcome of the Exodus. They may, to some degree, have aided and facilitated and enriched the supreme outcome of the Exodus, but in the last analysis, they couldn't compete with it. The supreme outcome of the Exodus, the great purpose, the great culmination, the great omega point driving the whole enterprise, was this divine human relationship. At the end of the day, the relationship with God was everything. And you know, that note struck there in Exodus 19 verse 4 is in fact a feature of biblical religion. It's this undeviating thread that you'll find throughout the whole thing, that whatever privileges and benefits the people of God may enjoy, those privileges and benefits are subordinate to and possibly preconditions of the really great thing, the towering, peerless, all-surpassing thing, which is a relationship with the living and true God. You know, you and I can lose sight of that. Let me put it this way. Our grandest possession this morning as Christians is not the forgiveness of all our sins. Our grandest possession is not that righteous verdict which we have received from God in justification. Our grandest possession is not even that place that is reserved for us in the world to come about which I prayed just now. Now, our grandest possession as Christians this morning is God. Our relationship that we have with God Himself. Forgiveness and justification make possible that relationship, and for those realities, therefore, we are eternally grateful. The world to come will represent the ideal, optimal context for enjoying that relationship, and so it too excites us greatly, but it's the relationship itself that is the name of the game. The relationship is everything. Written over your Christian life, written over Christianity itself, are those two words of verse 4, to myself, to myself. There are many things that we believe as Christians, and we must believe them staunchly and stubbornly. There are many things we practice as Christians, and we must practice them earnestly and strenuously. But all our beliefs and all our practices are part of something bigger, something which transcends and eclipses them all, this relationship with God. They're all oriented toward that. The relationship is everything. Is that how you see it this morning? Or have you allowed your Christianity perhaps to become something less than a relationship with God? A series of doctrines that you're proud to have mastered so competently. A moral lifestyle that you've cultivated so carefully over many years. And those doctrines then, and that lifestyle, that's the summit. You aspire to nothing higher than that. If that's the case, you need to lift your eyes to where Moses' eyes and Israel's eyes are lifted here. The summit beyond all summits, a relationship with God. Settle for nothing less than that. Make sure that for you, being a Christian is entirely geared towards that. And so that's the first thing this morning. What is a relationship with God? It's a relationship that's everything. Secondly, it's a relationship that's elusive. It's a relationship that's elusive. So I said that verse 4 is this one sentence summary of the Exodus, and we've just focused now on its last two words, but what about the rest of it? How exactly does verse 4 summarize the Exodus? Does it highlight the great job the Israelites did of carefully killing all those lambs and applying their blood to the doorframes? Does it highlight the marvelous efficiency with which the Israelites left the land that night as soon as Pharaoh told them they must go? Does it highlight the Israelites bravely stepping out onto a strip of land which just a few moments earlier had been covered with the waters of the Red Sea? Well, the answers are no, no, and no. The summary there in verse 4 doesn't highlight those things. Why not? Well, because those actions by the Israelites, killing lambs, leaving hurriedly, walking between the parted waters, those actions by the Israelites were mere footnotes to the whole thing. The really significant components of the Exodus were the things God did. And so his actions are the focus of verse 4. God was instigating everything. The Exodus didn't consist in Israel's accomplishments. It consisted in God's accomplishments. And if then the Exodus, which we said was aimed at Israel having a relationship with God, if the Exodus was God's doing, then Israel's relationship with God was God's doing. In instigating the Exodus, God was thereby creating the relationship with which the Exodus culminated. Apart from God's actions, the relationship would never have happened. As he puts it there in verse 4, I brought you to myself. I brought you to myself. Israel hadn't come to this relationship. Israel hadn't entered this relationship with God. Those are the wrong verbs. They imply some kind of competence and control, which Israel simply didn't have. Now the fact is, Israel was brought into this relationship. That's the verb. Brought. I brought you to myself. God made the whole thing happen. And again then, that has a relevance which transcends these events of 1500 BC. Again, we're being taken here to the heart of the Bible's whole message. You see, no one ever has a relationship with God apart from being brought into it. Many people fail to understand that. You're a man who wants a girlfriend, and so you go on a dating website. There on the website you arrange a date with a girl who says on her profile that she enjoys films and sampling Spanish cuisine. So what do you do on this date? Well, you take her to the cinema, and after that, you take her out for a lovely paella somewhere. You're pretty sure then that that will be the way to her heart. And many people take a similar approach to God. Perhaps you're taking that approach to God. From bits and pieces that you've picked up about the Bible and about Christianity over the years, you've gotten the impression that God is really into church. And he's really into sexual decency, and he's really into acts of kindness to other people, and he's really into those kinds of things. And so you're going to church, and you're not sleeping around, and you're trying to help lots of needy people, and so on. And you're pretty sure then that you have found the way to God's heart, that you're doing the right things in order to engineer this relationship with God that you want. I need to tell you this morning that you're deceiving yourself if you're thinking like that. That approach might work with the girl on the dating website, I don't know. But I do know that it will not work with God. The fact of the matter is, you cannot engineer a relationship with him. That's what I mean by this word elusive. In my heading, something that's elusive is something that you can't get. It just keeps eluding your grasp. And however much you try by your efforts to initiate a relationship with God, you won't get it. And you can throw a whole load of religion at this project, and you can throw a whole dollop of morality at this project. And the relationship with God will still elude you nonetheless. Because the only way into a relationship with God for sinful human beings like us is being brought into it. That is the only way. In the language of this verse, we need some giant eagle's wings to come under us and convey us powerfully into a relationship with God. And at that point you might be thinking, what on earth is this preacher on about? What is this route then into a relationship with God? It all sounds very vague and obscure and mysterious. I mean, going to church and being good and being nice, that's simple and straightforward, but what are you on about, preacher? Well, this is where we need to go to the New Testament. To the New Testament's counterpart to Exodus 19 verse 4, because there is such a text, you know. A text that I think is meant to be read alongside this one. A text which seems to have in mind the language of this one. It's 1 Peter chapter 3 verse 18. Many of you will know it. Christ suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous. Why? That he might bring us to God. That he might bring us to God. Peter is saying, if you want a relationship with God, Christ must bring you into it. He must bring you into it by the bloody root of his own suffering at Calvary's cross. And so if you want a relationship with God this morning, forget trying to find a way to God's heart through the things that you think he likes. Instead, go to Jesus this morning. Go to the one who suffered once for sins. Say to him, Jesus, I believe you suffered for my sins. I believe you have dealt with all the filth and guilt that prevents a relationship between God and me. Please bring me to God. And if you do that, then those arms outstretched on that cross, they will become like eagle's wings. They will lift you up and bear your weight and convey you powerfully into a relationship with God which you in a million years could never possibly have engineered. Go to Jesus this morning. Go to Jesus. Let the outstretched arms of the crucified one be the wings that bear you aloft into a relationship with God. So what is a relationship with God? It's a relationship that's everything. It's a relationship that's elusive. But then thirdly, it's a relationship that's exclusive. It's a relationship that's exclusive. Now, relationship is a vague term. It can cover a whole range of things. So we must ask here, what kind of relationship with himself had God, through the Exodus, brought Israel into? Was it a kind of relationship which he had with other nations as well, so that Israel were, as it were, join a club? A fairly elite club, perhaps, but a club nonetheless, a group of nations with this kind of relationship to Yahweh. Well, no. Our passage is very clear about this. Indeed, it could hardly be more emphatic that this relationship into which Israel had been brought was unique and exceptional. It comes across in various ways. Let's work through them backwards. So there in the middle of verse 6, we have that reference to Israel being, by virtue of this relationship with God, a holy nation. And you know then that the basic meaning of holiness in the Bible is set apartness. Israel, in other words, through this relationship with God, has been set apart from all the other nations, because the other nations don't enjoy this relationship with God. Before that, in verse 6, we have this other phrase, "You shall be to me a kingdom of priests." A kingdom of priests, that's a reference to the whole Levitical system, as we call it, that is about to be established in Israel with its tabernacle and with its animal sacrifices and with its priests who worked in the tabernacle conducting the animal sacrifices, all of which then would enable Israel to approach God and engage with God. Other kingdoms didn't have that. Other kingdoms had their so-called priests, but those priests were utterly ineffectual and invalid and did nothing. But Israel, in this relationship into which God had brought her, Israel was a kingdom with real priests doing real work and really enabling engagement with God. Or then you go back a little bit further in the text into verse 5. And we have this phrase, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples. And that's fairly simple, easily understandable language, isn't it? You're packing your car to go on holiday and you chuck a whole load of things into the boot, and there's clothes that you chuck in, and there's tents that you chuck in, and shoes that you chuck in, and footballs that you chuck in, and all kinds of gear, and you don't pay too much attention, you just chuck it all in. But then of course you're also taking a laptop, or you're taking a phone or something like that, and you don't just chuck that in with the other stuff, because it's more valuable, it's more precious, it's a treasured possession, and so you carefully put that in another part of the car. And that's the picture here, that there are all the nations, and God owns them all, because the world is His. But then there's Israel. And Israel is valuable, and Israel is precious, and Israel is His treasured possession by virtue of this relationship. But it's the reference before that that I'm particularly interested in. And I think that we can, and I think the one that we can most easily overlook, and it's this that I think actually brings out more than anything the uniqueness and exceptionalness of the relationship. That reference to my covenant. My covenant. Perhaps covenant is not a word that sets our pulses racing. We just think of it as this very contractual thing, a covenant. It's all about terms and conditions. Covenant should set our pulses racing. That's why I read earlier on from the book, the prophecy of Ezekiel, Ezekiel chapter 16. And covenant is mentioned there, verse 8 of Ezekiel 16. When I passed by you again and saw you, behold, you were at the age for love, and I spread the corner of my garment over you and covered your nakedness. I made my vow to you and entered into a covenant with you, and you became mine. This is God speaking. To what is he referring? There's obviously an awful lot of picture language going on here. It's a kind of allegory, if you like, but historically speaking, to what is he referring? Well, he's referring to what happened at Sinai. The earlier part of that passage, when Israel is depicted as a child, this pathetic child, that's Israel's early history. But this entering into a covenant in verse 8, that's a reference to what happens at Sinai. And how is it depicted? This God kind of coldly holding out a contract and saying, sign there on the dotted line. No. It's depicted as a marriage, isn't it? It's depicted as God taking Israel as his bride and vowing to be her husband and saying, you are mine. You are mine. It's very tender, very intimate imagery. And that's the kind of relationship there into which God, through the Exodus, had brought Israel. An exclusive relationship, a covenantal relationship, a marital relationship in which he had sworn, I will be your husband. I will be your lover. I will be your groom. That's the kind of relationship we're talking about. And again, this takes us beyond Exodus 19. Most of you in this room this morning have done what I said a minute ago. And you have gotten past the stage of trying to find a way to God's heart through religion, through morality. And you have gone to Jesus. And you have known what it is to be born by his outstretched wings into a relationship with God. That is true of you, but perhaps you've forgotten since then, somewhere along the line, you've forgotten what kind of a relationship with God it is into which Jesus, the crucified Jesus, has brought you. And you've come to see it as just this very cold, formal thing, part of the furniture and the fixtures of your life, but you've lost sight of its intimacy, its marriage-likeness, its exclusiveness, that God loves you with an intimate, intense, undeviating kind of love. I mean, at some points in the Bible, the love of God for his people, the relationship into which his people have been brought, the intensity with which it's described is almost too much, isn't it? It's almost overwhelming. You think of that psalm that we sang just now, Psalm 139. And we misread that psalm so often and missing that psalm as though it's just this cold theological treatise on God's omniscience and God's omnipresence. He knows everything. He is everywhere. That's not what Psalm 139 is about. Psalm 139 is depicting God as this obsessed lover who cannot take his eyes off the psalmist, cannot take his eyes off his people. So that he knows where they are at any given point. He knows their daily routines, not because he's this omniscient God, true though that is, but because he's gazed on them and he's studied them and he can't take his eyes off them. And he knows in that sort of compulsive, obsessive way where they are at any moment, when they sit down, when they lie down. And he's always with them, and wherever they go, he'll go as well, because he's this intense, exclusive, covenantal lover. That's the kind of God he is. Are you basking in that this morning as a believer? Have you forgotten it? Do the words "a relationship with God" just sound like throwaway words to you now in your Christian life? The relationship with God into which Jesus, through his sufferings, has brought you is a relationship of extraordinary intensity. A relationship that's exclusive. So a relationship that's everything, a relationship that's elusive, a relationship that's exclusive. And then one more thing. What is a relationship with God? It's a relationship that's embraced. It's a relationship that's embraced. So a relationship then like that, like what I've just described, a relationship like the one Psalm 139 is depicting, like the one Ezekiel 16 is depicting, the Bible's own commentary, if you like, on Sinai, Ezekiel 16, this lover taking a bride to himself. A relationship like that, it cannot work if it remains one-sided. It cannot work if it remains one-sided. Being in that kind of relationship, being related to like that by God, the Israelites couldn't themselves just have a casual attitude to God. There'd be something impossibly incongruous about that, wouldn't there? On the one hand, on the one side of the relationship, this God who's so passionate and so devoted and so obsessed. On the other side of the relationship, oh yeah, he's our God. That'd be ridiculous. It'd be so lopsided, so asymmetrical. A relationship like this must be embraced. And that's what our text is talking about in verse 5. Those words, obey my voice and keep my covenant. Obey my voice and keep my covenant. That's the obvious, the self-evident responsibility of those who are loved like this and related to like this by God. Obeying his voice and keeping his covenants. And again, I just want to close then challenging you, if you're a Christian this morning. Perhaps as a Christian you have come to this place where you almost think that you can kind of tune in and out of your relationship with God, and when you have time you can give some attention to it, but the rest of the time then you just have to kind of assume it and leave it in the background of your life. No, not when he takes it this seriously. Not when he takes it this seriously. Surely it must be embraced. Surely having been brought into such an extraordinarily intense, exclusive relationship with the living God through the sufferings of Christ, you have to live accordingly. You have to live in a way that befits that. Striking, isn't it? The way Israel responds there in verses 7 and 8. Moses comes down and puts God's words to them in verse 7. And then verse 8, all the people answered together and said, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. It's striking because they don't even know yet at this point really what it is that they're signing themselves up to. All the Sinai stuff is yet to come. All God's law is yet to come. But you see, okay, they won't live up to this in the future, but at this point at least, they're so in awe of the fact that the God of the universe wants them and wants this kind of relationship with them. They're so in awe of that that they feel at this moment that they just want to do whatever pleases that God. Whatever pleases that God. And they will fail in that, but the impulse in that moment is a right impulse. And I ask you then, this morning, as a Christian, is that your impulse? If this God, the God of creation, the God of the stars, the God of the galaxies, the God of infinite majesty and glory, if this God wants to be in a relationship with me that's this intense and this exclusive, then take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee. May that be the impulse of us all. Amen.